You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
On the east coast of Canada, we witnessed the collapse of the cod fishery in the last half of the 20th century. On the west coast, wild salmon populations have declined dramatically. Now, a four-year study of 7,800 marine species around the world ecosystems has concluded that the long-term trend is clear and predictable. An international team of marine researchers has published a study in Science magazine that projects the total collapse of edible fish populations by the year 2048. To discuss the report and to explore alternative scenarios, we've contacted David Helvarg. David is president of the Blue Frontier Campaign and author of the books 50 Ways to Save the Ocean and Blue Frontier, Dispatches from America's Ocean Wilderness. And David Helvarg joins me from Washington, D.C. Good morning, David.
Morning, Lorraine.
Can you sketch the details of the scenario drawn by the research team? What would biological diversity of the ocean environments look like by 2048 if we continue business as usual?
Well, by 2048, there'd be at least commercial extinction of most of the marine wildlife we now target for seafood. It would mean that almost all species that we consume, from tuna to red snapper, grouper to cod, would be below 10% of their historic biological mass and essentially not worth the gas to go out and find these last few remnants. And it would have a cascading effect. Of course, a lot of these fish we like to eat are predator fish and keystone species in maintaining the diversity and health of different marine habitats, be they coral reefs or seagrass meadows or the kelp forests of northern coastal areas. So really they're just taking an extrapolation of the trends that exist and playing them out to the mid-century, at which point we've gone from millennia of relying on the oceans as a source of protein and livelihood to a state where we essentially have a global Dead Sea.
Now, I understand that the researchers found that all of the major fish that we're used to eating in the fish food economy will decline, but also other species as well.
Yeah, the relation, you know, when you look, I mean, I've been places, like if I dive in the Florida Keys, East Dry Rocks, an area that as a kid I first went and it was 90% live coral cover. Today it's about 2% live coral, and a lot of that's being eaten away by snails and other critters that normally would be predated on by lobster. There's been such a strong lobster fishery around there that the predators are gone and these are coming up. At the same time, you have urban and agricultural runoff that's generating algae blooms. The algae is covering and smothering the corals, and a lot of the algae eaters have also been taken out of the system and basically put onto our dinner plates.
So it goes beyond then the actual loss of a large fish that we might eat and affects the ocean ecosystems as well.
Yes, and I think in the report they state it's not just this massive industrial overfishing, but at the same time, we're seeing the loss through development and pollution of the salt marshes and the coastal habitats, mangroves and seagrass meadows that really act as the nurseries as well as the filters of the sea. So we're taking down the populations of wild fish and marine critters at the same time that we're displacing, destroying, or cementing over really what act as the essential nurseries of the most productive areas, the coastal oceans, the salt marshes, the seagrass meadows, and the like. And so, you know, the diversity is being hit from both ends. You know, we're eating down from the top, and we're destroying the places where they go to breed and reproduce and where the fry, the small fish, normally have their habitats.
What are the root causes that are driving this trend?
Well, I think and Boris Worms and Rand Myers at Dalhousie, who he's worked with, they're looking back. And, you know, it's interesting. We usually don't think of militarization or globalization as having that much to do with the seafood we order in the local restaurant. But these are forces, really. It was World War II. We developed the military technologies like sonar and radar and later satellite tracking, as well as stronger hulls and diesel engines. we've essentially developed the military technologies to track down fish to their last refuges in deep water and in the mid-ocean areas, literally tracking them by satellite and airplane today. And using military technologies in this kind of war of extermination, where we've seen the global seafood catch rise from 20 billion metric tons at the end of World War II to almost 100 million by the mid-80s and declining since then. And part of this voracious, highly capitalized targeting is because we've seen globalization of the seafood market, so that there's now demand for almost anything indigenous to the sea. Sea urchins and skates are captured here in North America, shipped to Asia, where they're a delicacy. The gonads are, eaten in, nightclubs 24 hours after they're captured off of British Columbia or Alaska. At the same time, we're consuming 70% of the world's tuna demand is in North America. So essentially, it's very similar to what we saw with the buffalo, which were hunted sporadically throughout the 19th century, but in the 1870s, saw this convergence of technology of the Sharps repeating rifle with the railheads, the means of transporting buffalo skins to the markets in the East, and within a decade, 99% of the buffalo were gone. We're in that situation with marine wildlife today, where we now have the technologies to catch fish anywhere and the global market demand that on any day you'll have 100,000 varieties of and pounds of fish in the Tokyo fish market, where something like a bluefin tuna has gone for as much as $100,000 for a single fish.
Wow, that's stunning. Now, the lead researcher for the study, Dr. Boris Worms of Halifax, explained that this isn't actually a prediction, but a projection if current trends continue. Now, as the author of a book called 50 Ways to Save the Ocean, you must agree that there are alternative scenarios.
Exactly, and really the most frustrating for me, the most frustrating part of reports like this is that we know what the solutions are. It's finding the political will to act on them. I mean, we know if we stop taking fish faster than they can reproduce, that there is a tremendous resiliency, and we've seen places where we've created protected zones where we've seen the fish come back, and what we're looking is to protect what Mark Dixon, a fishery scientist out of Oregon State, calls fat old females. That's what you want in the ocean. These are the fish that are most fecund, and they lay the most eggs, and their eggs are the most viable. And, you know, we need to really protect the habitats to allow the species to come back. And as I say, here in the U.S. there have been two major ocean commissions in the last 4 years with over 300 recommendations, and, to reduce the runoff pollution, to control the fishery pressure. We know how to do it. It's making the decision that we're going to do it, that we want to, we're getting so much from the oceans in terms of recreation, transportation, trade, energy, protein, and just that sense of awe and wonder, that we really have to make a commitment as individuals and citizens to give something back.
Now, you've developed a clever acronym that spells out an approach to marine conservation, BLUE, Blue. Let's explore the ideas behind that. You've got them termed buybacks, limited entry, undersea reserves, and enforcement. So B stands for buybacks. What are you getting at there?
Yeah, this is just how we could deal with fisheries. Buybacks is simply that one of the things that's happened in the last 50 years has been tremendous overcapitalization of the global fishing fleet. A lot of governments have subsidized the growth of these fleets to where, as I say, they're catching more fish than can reproduce. And what's been done in a limited practice here in the U.S. and a few other places is where industry and government begins to buy back some of those surplus boats and basically takes the fleet down to the level that you can do sustainable fishery.
The second letter is a limited entry, L?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
That's related to it. That's essentially through buybacks and other programs of whether it's a program of sharing, cap and trade for fish, essentially, licensing certain quotas in the fishery or regulation, essentially limiting the take to what the biological complex of fisheries and ecosystems can sustain. And the science is getting better, and in a few places, like off Alaska, they're actually letting the science determine how much fishing power is allowed into the resource. So, you know, buybacks, limited entry, and I'll move on to the U because underwater reserves, the idea that we really need wilderness parks in the ocean. This is something scientists have been saying since at least 1990, that we need to take 20% of the world ocean and set it aside as fully protected reserves, because what you find is when you have non-extractive areas where there's no fishing or mining or drilling, that there is still tremendous resiliency, and especially when you target the areas that are the breeding areas and the unique ecosystems in the ocean, the coral reefs and the kelp forests and the like, that there's a quick comeback, that we've seen where they stopped targeting swordfish, for example. Within 5 years, you saw reproductive age classes of swordfish coming back. And where some of these reserves exist, like in Western Australia, the fishermen now endorsing them because they see there's a spillover effect that the lobsters are coming outside the reserves and in larger size and quantity. But it's not simply, in my way of thinking, it's not just to do it for the sake of fishery management, but we really need to understand that most of our planet is salt water and has unique ecosystems that need protection. Just like we have great provincial and national parks on land, we need to start looking to the ocean as places where we need this kind of protection. And it will help the marine wildlife come back.
The last letter in your blue solution stands for enforcement. Why is that important?
Because we've got lots of good environmental laws on paper, and right now there's little enforcement. We need agencies like the Coast Guard and to be out there and enforce the rules. And we've seen that there's this market incentive. As there are fewer fish, the prices go up, and this creates an incentive for some fishermen to turn pirate. And they're targeting the high dollar value fish, the salmon and the bluefin tuna and the lobster and the abalone. And you need law enforcement out there on the water. You know, this is still a vast wilderness. We've only mapped about 5 to 10% of the ocean. With the resolution, we've mapped the moon. So it still is a very wild and lawless place, and we need to put some law out there and put some teeth into these. We need to focus on the solutions, and then we need to have the enforcement power, or else the pirates run rampant.
David, earlier you talked about the political will that was necessary to solve this problem. And I want to just ask you a little bit more about that, because it seems like it can be a kind of intractable problem in the sense that it's a global problem, and yet we have national governments that have their own interests at stake in terms of fisheries. What do you think it's going to take to generate the political will to see governments around the world cooperate to divert this this potential environmental disaster?
Well, I remember years ago covering the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, and in the midst of this, there was this march at night of 30,000 people, and half from the poor favelas around the city and half global environmental activists, and all led by these Buddhists with cell phones and a big banner that said, "When the people lead, the leaders will follow." I really think it's going to take a bottom-up citizen movement, what I call a seaweed or marine grassroots activism, to get the politicians engaged. And I've seen it. I just recently, a few weeks ago, there was a California World Oceans Conference down in California. And this is a state where people have that sense of entitlement and understand that the oceans and the exclusive economic zones of the world belong to all of us. They're a public resource. And because there is that sense of engagement there, the governor came out to the conference, and there was commitments of funds and strategy to begin planning what's called ecosystem-based management for the coast and oceans. And it doesn't have to be in a single state or province. I mean, this is what has to be done. Is we've got lots of local examples where people are reducing pollution, introducing advanced sewage treatment in Key West, Florida, or creating marine reserves in Northwest Hawaii and other parts of, the world. I mean, places like Mozambique, poor countries that have created major offshore protected zones. And what we have to do is take these small examples and scale them up to the global, regional, and global level, because it's a global ocean. We have a Law of the Seas Convention. We have to start looking at engaging at the international level. There's a proposal in the United Nations to ban deep sea trawling, where these bottom trawlers literally just scrape the bottoms of all their complexity and their diversity in order to get some flatfish. And, you know, unfortunately, the United States has not signed on to the Law of the Seas Convention. Canada tends to be looking at it more as an opportunity to do a land grab in the melting Arctic than as a conservation measure. And yet, you know, we have potential legislation at the state and national levels. We have global agreements that can be used really to turn things around. And each of us as individuals have ways that we can impact the oceans around us, whether it's the food choices we choose to eat, more healthy and sustainable fish, or more vegetarian and organic food because of a lot of the industrial fertilizers and synthetic chemicals put on industrial farmlands wash off into the ocean and create these algae blooms and dead zones. You know, our energy choices have impacts, because if you're using coal-fired electricity, that coal's most carbon-intensive fossil fuel, and it's intent, you know, it's warming the oceans and killing bleaching corals and intensifying hurricanes, and also putting mercury, a neurotoxin, up the smokestack, which rains out into the oceans and comes back to our food web and our tuna fish sandwiches. Each of us have many options we can work on as consumers and as citizens. You know, we have to both make the choices in our lives that will not only help the seas around us, but will tend to improve our own physical health and financial well-being, and at the same time, you know, giving something back to the oceans. And we have to hold our politicians responsible for this, for our great ocean commons, this last public trust. And it's really, you know, in a democracy, we need to act to protect our resources as, you know, not just what we get out of them, but as a heritage that we pass on.
Well, David, it's been great talking with you this morning, and we'll refer people to your excellent website, which has a lot more that we can learn to do.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Okay, take care.
Take care. You too. Bye.
I've been speaking with David Helvarg. David is president of the Blue Frontier Campaign and the author of Blue Frontier: Dispatches from America's Ocean Wilderness. And for more information on this issue, you can visit the Blue Frontier Campaign website at bluefront.org.